Congress approved a sweeping piece of legislation that aims to boost funding for medical research, accelerate development of new drugs, and fight cancer. The bill was approved yesterday in the Senate.
In addition, the 21st Century Cures Act includes substantial mental health provisions. These include mandating equal treatment for mental and physical conditions, making grants available to hire more mental health workers, and providing funding to fight the opioid epidemic. President Obama has promised to sign the bill when it arrives on his desk.
Here's one of the bill's sponsors, Michigan Congressman Fred Upton, speaking at its signing this morning.
Folks that have a disease know that it will take them without a cure. This bill is going to fix that problem because it expedites the approval of drugs and devices and is coupled with literally billions of dollars in more research that will find the answer for those cures years ahead of what it otherwise would have been.
Ron Hohnberg is with us now. He's senior policy advisor at the National Alliance on Mental Illness, or NAMI. Ron, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Well, some very enthusiastic speech there from one of the bill's sponsors, Fred Upton from Michigan. Do you echo that enthusiasm about the potential of this bill?
Absolutely. There are also some very important mental health provisions in the bill that I know we'll talk about later. But, you know, the fact is that we desperately need to speed up the research process. We desperately need new ways to treat a variety of diseases in this country, including mental illnesses. There hasn't been a new promising medication for treating schizophrenia, for example, in a number of years. And, you know, we have to certainly achieve a proper balance between expediting the approval process and making sure that people are safe. But, you know, we think the bill does that, and we also like the fact that the bill puts resources into the National Institute of Health for a variety of reasons, and also the Federal Brain Initiative, which is focused on a variety of neurological and mental health conditions. So, yes, it's a major step forward.
As you said, your organization focuses on mental health and treating, maybe curing mental illness. What do you see there that you're optimistic about?
Well, I mean, a lot has to happen. You know, mental illness is one of the, you know, if you look at the costs of untreated mental illness in this country and the consequences of untreated mental illness, you know, the mental illness is right there at the top in terms of being a public health crisis, along with addictions disorders. So we have a lot of work that has to be done to address that problem. And this bill represents a very good start. I mean, for the first time, really, Congress has identified mental health and substance use disorders as a priority and has passed a comprehensive bill to try to, you know, address the crisis of untreated mental illness. Of course, there's always a long way to go from the moment of passage to implementation, but, you know, this lays a very promising foundation.
Why do you think it's taken long for mental illness to have a bit of the same parity among healthcare concerns that physical wellness has had?
Well, I mean, I think there's obviously been a lot of historical, you know, some people use the term stigma. I tend to use the term prejudice and discrimination towards mental illness, sort of stereotypical assumptions that mental illness equates with dangerousness, a reticence to talk about mental illness. I think back to 40, 50 years ago when we didn't really like to talk about cancer. And fortunately, that has changed in this country now. And people talk about their struggles with cancer and get all sorts of support from people surrounding them these days. We haven't reached that point with mental health. I think we're starting to make some progress. But, you know, it's always been one of those conditions that people have sort of laughed about, have sort of tried to avoid talking about. And that has translated into lack of adequate attention at federal and state legislative levels.
If everything goes forward smoothly and as you'd like it to proceed with funding and implementation, what do you think could be the outcome in terms of preventing the consequences of untreated mental illness?
Well, you know, a number of aspects of this bill that I think can really be helpful. For example, an emphasis on early identification and intervention in the treatment of serious mental illness. Historically, the mental health system has been characterized as a crisis-oriented system. We sort of wait till people go into crisis before we intervene, and then oftentimes those interventions involve the police or they involve hospitalizations. The intervention lasts only as long as necessary to alleviate the immediate crisis. But you know, early identification, intervention, and prevention have not been hallmarks of the mental health system historically. So, you know, this bill creates some new funding streams and also reconfigures some existing funding streams to emphasize intervening early, particularly with young people when their symptoms first emerge, which is so important. I mean, a 16-year-old, for example, who first experiences or shows symptoms of possible psychosis. You know, historically, we've waited 5-10 years before that person has gotten treatment. By then, it's too late. The person has basically off the trajectory of their lives. Early identification and intervention really shows that we can actually enable young people to stay in school, maybe enter the workforce, live their lives despite their mental illnesses. It's like any other disease. So that's important. The bill puts resources into alternatives to incarceration for people. I'm sure your listeners know that our jails and prisons are full of people with mental illnesses. Many of these facilities have been characterized as de facto mental health treatment facilities, but they're not treatment facilities at all. Many of these are for relatively low-level nonviolent offenders. So by putting resources into diverting people into treatment programs, that would serve not only a beneficial purpose for those individuals, but it would also serve a beneficial role for society in terms of reducing correctional costs. There's money put into supporting practices that have been proven through both research and implementation to really work in helping people recover. One that I would mention is assertive community treatment, which actually originated back in the early 70s in Dane County in, for people who were leaving Mendota State Hospital.
And I want to hear more about that in just a bit. We'll come back, continue our conversation with Ron Hornburg. He's Senior Policy Advisor with the National Alliance on Mental Illness. He's talking about mental health and addiction treatment provisions in the new 21st Century Cures Act, which Congress passed yesterday. Ron Hornburg with NAMI.
We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you happy to see Congress making mental health care and drug addiction a priority in this new bill? How do you hope it will address mental health and drug addiction issues you see in your community? Do you see access to mental health treatment, addiction treatment, where you live? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking about the new bipartisan bill passed by Congress yesterday, which not only aims to boost medical research and help combat cancer, but also, and this is what we're talking about now, address mental illness and drug addiction.
Ron Hornburg stays with us now. He's Senior Policy Advisor at the National Alliance on Mental Illness. And Ron, sorry to interrupt you there. You were talking about some innovative care intervention programs that sounds like pioneered in Dane County, Wisconsin. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Correct, yeah. So back in the early 70s, you know, there was an effort to try to reduce the numbers of people who had been hospitalized for long periods of time at Mendota. And there was a program created called Assertive Community Treatment, which, you know, is just it is what it sounds like. It's a very intensive approach to services that, basically doesn't just provide people with medication, but also the kind of supportive services that people need, intensive case management, counseling, substance abuse treatment if it's needed, a variety of other services, and is available 24-hour, 7-day-a-week basis. It includes mobile crisis management. The whole philosophy is based on going to the person where they are so that they don't show up for an appointment. You don't close their case. You go out and find them, and you try to intervene even if they're under a bridge at that time. And it was used with people who had very severe illnesses, and it was very, very successful in preventing rehospitalization. hospitalizations and arrests and some of the really bad things that happen to people when they don't get help. And for a long time, and there was a lot of research done on it that shows that it worked and was implemented across the country. And in the last 10, 15 years, we've kind of gotten away from it because it is relatively expensive, though far less expensive than hospitalizing or incarcerating people. And this bill really tries to reconfigure resources to help support programs like assertive community treatment that really are proven effective in helping people who are most at risk.
To do that, you need adequate numbers of psychologists and social workers, don't you, to get out there and work one-on-one with people?
Yeah, you do, and that's a big problem in mental health. There's a severe workforce shortages, particularly in rural areas, and I know Wisconsin has a number of rural areas as well. So, there are attempts to try to address that through resources for telepsychiatry, and also some fellowship programs, loan forgiveness programs, incentives to try to attract people into the mental health field, and not just psychiatrists and psychologists, but also physicians' assistants, social workers, peer counselors, nurses, etc. Is it enough? I think it's a step in the right direction, but we're certainly going to need to work systematically on addressing these workforce shortages. It's a big problem.
Let's take a quick call here. We've got Dave joining us in Barron, Wisconsin. Dave, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I'm encouraged by the passion of this, but as with anything, I think the devil is in the details. We are part of the rural that you mentioned. Out here, the lack of services is key. As far as I've been in recovery for a long time, 29 years, and I luckily recovered in the Twin Cities where treatment center in every corner, halfway house, AA meetings, NA meetings. So access to services was great. Here, non-existent. And there again, that you've got a very limited number of AA, no treatment facilities whatsoever for substance abuse.
Dave, thank you so much. I want to make sure our guests can respond. We're just about out of time. And briefly, Ron, what about addressing needs of rural Wisconsin when it comes to mental health
and addiction? Thank Dave. For that. That's so important. This bill will help, but not solve all the problems. I do want to make one point. There's a lot of talk about, I'm sure your listeners are aware about dismantling the Affordable Care Act and particularly making some changes to Medicaid, which is the most important source of funding for mental health services, block granting Medicaid. To block grant a program means to limit the federal funding, to put a cap on federal funding. That would be potentially disastrous for the people we've been talking about in this call. So I'm not saying this in a partisan way. I want to make the point that Republicans were a huge part of getting this bill passed. But going forward, there are other steps that will need to be taken, and we want to make sure not to take steps that are going to, hurt this effort.
Ron, thanks a lot for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me.
That was Ron Hohnberg, Senior Policy Advisor at the National Alliance on Mental Illness. If you hear someone talking through their nose or calling something interesting when it's clearly less than a desirable thing, it might be safe to conclude that they're speaking Midwestern, according to our next guest.
But don't tell that to us Midwesterners. A lot of us believe we don't have an accent at all, and that, in fact, we're speaking the most authentic version of American English.
In his new book, How to Speak Midwestern, writer Edward McClelland explores the origins of the unique patterns and phrases that make up Midwestern dialogue, and he joins us now. Edward, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, how are you doing?
Doing well. So are you saying that we're wrong about this idea that we in the Midwest do not have an accent, that they were the one group of people in the country who don't really have anything going on that's quirky or unusual accent-wise?
Absolutely. And that was a bit of a Midwestern accent right there. I just raised my A. That's part of the northern city's vowel shift, which is prevalent all the way from Rochester, New York to Milwaukee. It's what makes people talk about a can of pop. So I kind of wrote this book to attack the notion that we in the Midwest are the bland middle, that we're the standard, that there's nothing exotic or colorful about us. There are many different Midwestern accents, and there are all kinds of interesting and quirky phrases we have in the Midwest that are unfamiliar to any other part of the country.
How did the no accent idea come along? I mean, we think of the Southern accent, which is actually a whole bunch of different accents, and then East Coast type accents being distinctive in their own way. How did we get this self-concept that we are accentless?
Well, in the 1920s, the leading accent expert was a man named John S. Kenyon, who was at Hiram College in Ohio. And at that time, sort of the most prestigious accent was what you called a transatlantic accent. And it came up again in the last few days as people played the speech that FDR gave after "We were suddenly and deliberately attacked by the Empire of Japan." And, of course, he dropped his R's there. And John S. Kenyon was from Cleveland, and he decided the standard pronunciation should be what he was hearing in northeastern Ohio. So he said, when you say war, not war. And when you say not, not not, which were features of the Inland North speech he heard in northeastern Ohio. So a lot of elements of Midwestern speech were standardized, and this was picked up by NBC, and they gave these instructions to their broadcasters. I think one thing that's made Midwestern speech a little more distinctive since then has been the rise of the Northern Cities vowel shift, which is said to be the most, the biggest change in English vowel pronunciation in 1,000 years.
Give us an example or two.
Well, as I was saying before, two of the big features are, one is A raising, which makes people say things like can and sand and absolutely. And the other is called O fronting, which makes people draw out their vowels. I'll give you a little bit of an off-color example that was on the TV series Family Guy. You know how they do those cutaways?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They did one of a Wisconsin woman having sex. And she was saying, "Oh, God, oh, God, oh, crap, oh, crap, oh, crap." And those are two examples of the vowel shift right there.
But I guess,
so the rest of the country is noticing.
Okay, so you gave the words can and and.
Can, I think, and.
Do I do that? I don't hear it. Do I can and? Am I doing
no,
it?
No, you're not doing it, but you're on the radio.
Oh.
You're a broadcaster. Broadcasters are supposed to not have any regional isms in their speech.
Yeah, and yet there's me. And
you're
and
doing like, it a little
some,
more.
I have some Michigan ones that I know are Michigan, partly from your book, like 5, 6, 7.
I'll say seven.
Uh-huh. I don't know. I'm exaggerating, but every or... Yeah, there's a lot of words where you turn the E into like a short
like
U sound.
Well, that's another aspect of it. It's called short E, short U confusion. And I'm in Lansing, Michigan, which is where I grew up right now. And it's got to be the capital of that because I went to the post office today and the clerk said, that'll be $37.70. Will that be debit or credit?
Yeah, I can hear
that's,
it when you
that's
say
that's kind of me, yeah.
Yeah.
So, another one you talk about is, you don't use the word honking, but I'm going to say sort of honking things out our nose. Is that part of this?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, talking through your nose. You know, one of the example, I'm doing a book tour and I play a lot of well-known people with Midwestern accents. I play Michael Moore. He's certainly nasal. My tip for speaking Midwestern is to talk as though the lower half of your jaw doesn't exist. Just make everything go through your nose. There's a saying, because we also sort of really exaggerate our R's. You'll say, well, I'm going out to the garage to work on my car's engine. And so there's a saying that sometimes Midwesterners can sound like pirates with head colds.
That's kind of cool, I guess.
Yeah, we can only aspire to that. So there's you point out that there's not just one Midwestern, there's multiple Midwestern dialects, and even variation among ethnic groups, racial groups, urban, rural.
Sure.
Can you sort out some of that for us?
Well, I identified three main dialects. Those were and they were all based on patterns of settlement and immigration. The first I was talking about was the Inland North accent, which was brought here by New Englanders migrating west along the Erie Canal and Lake Erie. And there's a Midland accent, which was spread west by the Scots-Irish, who started in Baltimore and Philadelphia. And then there's the North Central accent, which is in northern Wisconsin, the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and Minnesota, and that was derived from the speech of Scandinavians and Germans. And Wisconsin is the only state that has all three. And one thing I point out in the book is I talk about the movie Making a Murderer, not the movie, but the documentary series. And it's interesting, I looked on a map, and the on the dialect map I had, the line between the inland north accent and the north central accent goes right through Manitowoc County. And you can certainly hear that the Averys, the, you know, the rural people, have more of that sort of rustic north country accent. And the people, the prosecutors in the county seat, have a more urbanized inland north accent. So there's an interesting, I guess, sort of rural-urban and upper-class, lower-class split there that's reflected in the accents you hear in the series.
Is there an accent from the United States right now that is in favor, that people aspire to sound like? Or if you're from a particular region, do you basically think everybody else sounds just a little dumb?
Probably the Midland accent that you would hear in, central Ohio, central Indiana, central Illinois. That's kind of now considered the most accentless part, at least of the Midwest. When you go out west, I think the regional accents are not quite as strong, because I guess people lost them as they, when they went that far and mixed together. I'm just studying the Midwest, but as far as the Midwest, probably that region is considered the most accentless and not really something you can parody. I mean, some of the people I can point to that have that accent would be Mr. Rogers on TV, and you don't really think of him as having a strong accent, or John Kasich, the presidential candidate. But I don't think anybody... I could hear that he had a Midland accent, but nobody really seemed to pick up on it or comment on it.
So as you've talked about, these accents have changed, come in and out of favor over history. What do you see maybe changing now? We're all watching TV with people with similar accents. Are we getting homogenized now, or are we really keeping our accents where they are?
Well, one thing I learned doing this was that every accents are always changing. Every generation has its own sound, just like every generation has its own slang. And I think what's actually leveling accents is not TV, because nobody watched more TV than the baby boomers, and they've got stronger accents than millennials. I think it's education and social mobility. A couple of weeks ago, I went to watch a Bears game on the south side of Chicago in a tavern, and I was mostly there with guys in their 50s and 60s, and they had the stereotypical Chicago accent, just what you heard the super fan skit parodying. They were asking about the squares, and the score was 13 to 10. Someone said, "What are the squares?" Zero and tree. And then on the way home, I got on the train with a guy, and it turns out he was his 30s, and he was a firefighter. So nobody would have minded if he'd had an accent, but he said, "Yeah, my dad had a Chicago accent, but my mom beat it out of me. She didn't want me talking that way at all." So I think there's kind of developed an attitude that any kind of strong regional accent, no matter what it is considered kind of, I guess, unsophisticated. And you were asking about differences between races and different groups. You know, you'll find these regional accents are strongest in white people who are from the area and their parents are from the area. They probably didn't go to college, and they have jobs that don't require a lot of interaction with people from outside the area, maybe people like, firefighters or police officers or hairdressers, what have you. One thing I found was that the Midwest has the biggest accent segregation or variation in accents between races, because when African Americans moved up here, they were basically relegated to ghettos. They had no social or professional interaction with whites, and to a large extent, they retained the speech patterns that they had brought with them from the South.
So, Edward, we're just about out of time, but lightning round, last question. What are your favorite one or two Wisconsinisms?
Someone reminded me of one. Well, of course, fib, that's got to be one of my favorite because that's what I am.
Can't spell it out, though.
What's that? F-I-B?
Yeah, no, I said we can't spell out what that means. Yeah.
You can't spell out what that means. You can't spell out what fish tab means either, but I think some people might know. I like squeaky cheese.
Squeaky cheese.
Yeah, I like, and somebody reminded me that I left this out, but I'll put it in as an extra, behind the cheddar curtain.
I don't think I've heard that, but I love it.
That's another word for the state line. The 50-yard line, which is State Highway 50, and it goes through Racine, and Kenosha. That's supposed to be the line between Bears fans and Packer fans.
Awesome. Well, we'll leave it there, Edward. Thanks a lot for joining us. It's been fun.
Okay, thanks for having me.
That was Edward McClellan, author of several books, including his latest, the one we were talking about now, called How to Speak Midwestern.